Welcome to the current federal tax developments here as we hit Labor Day and the end, I guess, or unofficial end of summer. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute, a Kaplan company, and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we've had a lot of things happening going on in taxes, and much of it came up related to the hurricane and tropical storm Harvey that hit parts of eastern Texas last week. We're going to talk about some of that relief. We have some issues here where we talk about the premium tax credit and owing that back to the government, even if the exchange fouled up and didn't correct the amount you should have been billed. We'll talk about putting a child in a pageant and how we report that income. We'll find out about a black hole in which a taxpayer's refund fell into. We'll also take a look at an IRS special grant of relief for partnerships this year. We'll discover the problems of establishing whether you really did file that extension. And we'll end with the discussion of the IRS's definition of what is marriage. In essence, in what cases do they recognize a couple as married? Well, I got a few things coming up now, again, coming up for work here at the end of the year, at the end of the month, in terms of sessions. And we wanted to bring up, remind you of a couple of things. First, we've got a few courses going in New York City for the New York State Society of CPAs. On September the 28th, Don Cochran will do a full-day session on current federal tax developments, looking at what's happened in taxes over the past year. And the following day, on the 29th, he'll do a session on real estate partnerships, get in, get out, get taxed. These sessions will be both in-person sessions by the New York Society in their offices in Manhattan, and will also be webcast. If you want to sign up for those courses, you can find out about them at https://cpe.nysscpa.org. That stands for New York State Society of CPAs. Also want to remind you that I have coming up about the same time a set of courses in the Cincinnati area of Ohio, it's actually in Fairfield. We'll have courses on the 27th, 2 4-hour courses, one course in the morning on the alternative minimum tax, and in the afternoon, a 4-hour session on the passive activities rules, enabling clients to survive IRS challenges in this area. And on the 28th of September, I'll be doing a session that'll talk about the multi-state taxation of businesses. Now, these are again in the Fairfield, Ohio, is where we'll be located, where you know the Ohio Society normally has their Cincinnati programs. And if you want to sign up for these programs, which are offered only live, you can find those at www.ohiocpa.com. That's how you sign up for those. Now let's take a look at what we have this week in terms of actual tax developments. And the first couple I want to talk to is obviously, as you all should be aware, a hurricane followed by a really nasty tropical storm version of the Harvey. Hit eastern Texas, dumping a rather insane amount of rain on the Houston area, and also then went back and hit a few other areas to the east of Houston and into Louisiana. Because of this, the IRS issued information this week regarding some relief. This was in news release IR 2017-135. At the same time, the Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts on their website posted information related to Hurricane Harvey and Tropical Storm Harvey on their page titled Declared Natural Disasters and Emergencies Tax Help. And a couple of things happened here. First thing is on the IRS site. The counties covered by this are all the counties that have been designated as federal disaster areas. Now, we have a set of them that was listed when this was released on the 28th of August. Since then, additional damage has occurred as the storm moved to the east and then started moving north. So there are more counties now that are on there than were there initially. But obviously, basically, the whole Houston area is covered by this. And if you have questions about whether your client's counties are covered, obviously, you keep up on the IRS website. They'll let you know. Now, relief is automatically granted to any taxpayer who has an address of record located within the disaster area. So the theory of that is you don't have to apply for this relief. If you're a taxpayer whose address is outside the disaster area, but you've got records located within the disaster area, or you're a relief worker, that's working with a recognized organization that's involved in this program, you'll need to contact the IRS to discuss relief. The phone number for that is 866-562-5227. By the way, all this information is in the PDF that we publish every week with all the developments for that week in taxes. Now, what's going to happen is a lot of deadlines get pushed back to January 31st, 2018. In essence, you know, those individuals which have payment deadlines occurring starting on payment deadlines or filing deadlines that began on August the 23rd, for those in the initial declared area, for those who had their disasters declared at a later date because, you know, the storm stayed in Houston for a while and then later moved to the east. Those who were added later, the date moves to whenever your county got added. But we're going to delay these issues here. You know, you will not have to file returns or pay taxes that were due until January 31st, 2018. So in essence, your next due date for anything is January 31st, 2018. That will include the 2016 income tax returns that may be on extension right now. If you receive the extension, also estimated tax payments that are due on September 15th and January 16th. Those will now be due on January 31st if you're in those areas. It also will deal with things like payroll tax and excise tax return issues. In that case, you don't get all the way back to January 31st. For payroll taxes and excise tax returns, your late deposit penalties for payroll and excise taxes that were normally due on or after August 23rd and before September 7th will be timely if made by September 7th. Obviously, September 7th is going to be Thursday of the week following Labor Day. So you've got until then to get your payroll tax deposits done. The IRS did warn people, though, that, you know, any tax payments that were due on the 2016 return are still late. And any of these grants of disaster relief do not basically cover any penalty that was already running as of the date the disaster started. So if you're underpaid on your taxes for October 15th, or you should say for what would have been your 2016 individual income tax return, you're going to still owe the failure to pay penalty and you're going to owe the interest until January, you know, that'll keep running through January 31st. Because again, we had an email we discussed about 2 months ago where the IRS made this clear that these sort of disaster relief situations do not stop the running of penalties or interest if the penalties or interest have already started running, if you already failed to do something you should have done. Taxpayers who failed to pay enough in with their request for extension do not have those interest and penalties suddenly stop at this point. So that is important to note. Now, in addition to the IRS relief, we had relief come from the Texas Comptroller. In essence, if you look at this, the Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts granted its relief. And what it talked about in its frequently asked questions, if you're unable to timely file due to damage, items that have to be filed with the Comptroller of Public Accounts in Texas, you can call and request for a special 90-day extension. Unlike the IRS extension, this is one that is a case-by-case basis, so you have to call the Comptroller of Public Accounts and make your case for that extension. The page also has information about various taxes that are suspended for hotel taxes and sales taxes in certain situations in the emergency areas. They suspend or remove hotel taxes because people are going to have to stay in hotels who have been displaced. And there'll also be some sales taxes on certain items will also be suspended during the emergency period. Information about that is at the Comptroller of Public Accounts website. Again, the link to that can be found in the PDF document on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, under the click for the weekly updates and this week's update. Additional relief the IRS issued came later in the week on August the 31st in announcement 2017-11. This announcement deals with the issue of qualified retirement plans. And what it allows us to do, basically, qualified retirement plans, if they, you know, that are otherwise eligible to have had provisions that allow for this, you know, a plan could allow for hardship distributions if it meets certain requirements. or a plan may allow you to take loans against your account, again, meeting certain requirements. But if your plan doesn't have that language in it, even if it's, say, a 401k plan that's eligible for both hardship distributions and for loans to participants, if those aren't in the plan right now, well, technically you can't make those loans until the plan is amended. The IRS, as they did previously in earlier disasters, has provided special relief here. A plan can start offering the loans or the hardship distributions so long as it's eligible, if the plan had been amended, to be offering those sorts of distributions. And the key to this is that essentially we can both make a hardship distribution or we can offer loans even if we're not currently eligible to. Hardship is also defined more broadly than it is under the code. It's basically anybody who has any sort of financial distress related to Harvey. You don't have to meet the traditional definition of hardships that you would find in the regulations for the qualified plans. It also eliminates some of the requirements for documentations for a loan. Doesn't eliminate, but delays them. So we can actually make loans, assuming our plan's eligible to make a loan. We can make loans, and we can, as long as we get all the relevant information in a reasonable time frame, we can go ahead and, or at least we take reasonable steps to get it, we can go ahead and make these loans and these hardship distributions today. We're allowed for hardship distributions to accept an employee statement that they have a hardship, unless we know for a fact that essentially they're lying, they don't have one. You know, they're claiming a hardship because their home was supposedly flooded out when in fact their home never, you know, no flood waters came anywhere near their home. If you know for a fact it's false, yeah, you can't ignore that fact. But if you're not aware of that fact, then you're not going to be held accountable for it in the plan. We're not going to have plan qualification issues just because you accepted the employee statement. Now, while we do have this, a couple things are true. Number one, we have to have a plan that would be eligible to offer hardship distribution. For instance, a profit-sharing plan or a stock bonus plan can make hardship distributions. 401k plans are generally profit-sharing plans, unless you have a really ancient pre-ERISA money purchase pension plan. But for instance, the actual pension plans, defined benefit money purchase pension plans, are not allowed to make hardship distributions. This notice does not allow those plans to make it because they are not allowed to have the language. And one of the things that's going to be required is you've got to get the language in place to allow for plan loans and hardship distributions by the end of the first year, beginning after December 31st, 2017. If you're calendar year, that means by the end of next year, the end of 2018, to allow for this retroactively. You know, and basically, so that means we really can't offer hardship distributions unless we do that. The same thing about the plans, we have the same limitations on plan loans that apply. So you still have the $50,000 rule, the one-year look back, and all those issues that impact plan loans. If an employee doesn't make the repayment on time and they don't fix the problem within the fixing period that we talked about a couple weeks ago, then they'll have a distribution. All those rules will still apply. This merely allows plans to offer help today without having to wait for their plan to be amended, to get the plan amendment documentation put together, and then to get all the paperwork from employees that would be needed to back up the fact that this was a legitimate hardship distribution and or it's a proper loan. We can get that information later. So again, you have till December 31st, 2017 to fix your plan in this case. Let's move on then past the Harvey relief. Let's go ahead and go to our first one that's not Harvey. This is a issue of McGuire versus Commissioner, which is a published tax court decision. This is 149 TC number 9, issued on August the 29th, 2017. What this case deals with is a taxpayer had gone to the exchange in California. They had, you know, given the state exchange information about what their income had been for the prior year and what they expected it to be for the next year. Okay, based on that, they were given a premium. And this premium was actually, you know, effectively about half of what the actual gross premium was because they qualified per the exchange for a premium credit, so they got advance payment. So they had a plan that had a gross monthly premium of $1,181.97, but the actual amount they had to pay the exchange each month was $509.97. Now, as we all know, that's an estimate. The actual amount of the credit will be computed on their return. I should say we know that. Doesn't mean the taxpayers all know this, but that's a whole different problem. After they had submitted their material, and after the exchange had told them, here's what you're going to start paying next year, the wife took a job that paid $600 per week. That's going to be a problem because that job, when added to their income, was going to kick them over the 400% of the poverty level trigger, which means they weren't going to qualify for a credit. Now, there's no evidence the taxpayers understood this was going to totally disqualify them. But the taxpayers did tell the exchange, you know, we know income affects this, and we're going to have more income than we thought we were going to have when we applied to you. So they gave them the information about that extra amount. But the exchange never did take action on that. They, at one point, middle of the next year, sent a letter that vaguely discussed, the fact that they had to recompute the premium, or they had to recompute the credit at the end of the year. But that letter never made it to the taxpayer because, oh, by the way, they sent the exchange a new address, but the exchange never updated the address. So they never got that letter, and they never got the 1095A. Well, here comes the problem. Obviously, the IRS did get the 1095A, and the IRS sends them back a bill for the total $7,902 credit that they received for the prior year. The taxpayer said, wait, that's totally unfair. We bought our insurance from the exchange because it was only going to cost us $590 per month. Had we known the actual premium was going to be much higher, like twice as much, and it was going to cost us this much more, we would have gone elsewhere and gotten a cheaper policy. You know, they failed to tell us what the real cost of our policy was going to be, and we shouldn't be held accountable. The tax court agreed the exchange had not done its job, that the exchange should have communicated with them, understands how unfair this all appears, but the tax court is not a court of equity. So the tax court has to follow the law. So they still owed the excess premium credit. Bad news in that structure. Next up, we're going to send our child to a pageant. This is the case of Lopez versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-171, issued on August 30th. This deals with a part of the code that you don't deal with very often, Section 73 of the code. The taxpayer's minor daughter competed in various pageants. You know, she was 9 years old. She was 9 and 10, apparently, in the 2 years involved. She was in these various pageants for girls that she competed in their state. Though she did win, so she had some winnings from some of these pageants. These winnings were deposited in a savings account for her because the parents wanted her to use that for college eventually. Now, while she had these winnings, there were expenses way beyond those winnings. Those expenses, basically, she won $1,325 one year, $1,850 the next. The expenses that the parents paid out of their pocket were $21,732 in the first year and $15,445 in the second. So the parents reported all of this on their return because they paid everything. So they reported these losses. IRS challenges that. Now, you might think hobby loss, but that's not going to be the challenge here. Code Section 73 of the Internal Revenue Code specifically provides services of a child, income or expenses related to services performed by a child, are always reported on the child's return, regardless of whether the child actually got the winnings, you know, or somebody else did, and regardless whether the child paid the expenses. So the minor child has to pick those up per 73. So despite the fact that this is an exception to the normal rule, we say if you didn't pay the expense, you don't get the deduction. In this case, even though the daughter obviously did not pay the expenses, the daughter got the deduction. The daughter picked up the income. Well, at least she got that. but you also paid the expenses. Obviously, this wasn't a real good result for mom and dad, because mom and dad, their losses went away. And of course, they had all the other income that really subsidized this. Next up, an unusual case about how things in a refund can be lost for somebody who just doesn't file their taxes on time. We've all had these people, right? People that don't file on time, and they say they're not worried because I know I paid more than I owed. Well, as we're all aware, that's nice, but if you don't act fast enough, that refund can go away. This is a little bit of an odd way the refund can go away. The IRS issued a notice of deficiency. Now, as we all should be aware, generally you have 3 years from the due date of the return, right, including extensions, or 2 years from the date you paid the tax. Whichever expires later is the period for which you can file a claim for credit. This taxpayer had paid estimates during the year and then paid money with their extension. The taxpayer was relatively significantly overpaid. In this case, by the end of the time this was over, you know, she was looking at a refund in this case of, as I recall my number, somewhere around $40,000. Well, that's nice, actually $38,000. But here's the problem. She didn't file a return, but she had filed an extension on the original return. So let's follow the timeline. On January 17th of 2013, this involves her 2012 return, she made her final estimated tax payments on her 2012 return. Total estimates were $72,000. On April 15th of 2013, she files a 4868, pays $40,000 with that. So as of April 15th, 2013, she had paid in $112,000. Under the tax paid rule for estimates, this is the date we're deemed to have paid that tax, 112. On October 15th of 2013, the due date, which she had until the file, passed. Now, on June 15th of 2015, the IRS issues a notice of deficiency, and the tax return still wasn't filed. The IRS included only items of income they were aware of, which meant she had a lot of stock sales. So obviously, like the normal IRS method, they, you know, assume no basis. So there's this huge bill due. They actually had a deficiency of over $1.6 million. Now, June 15th is interesting because that is more than 2 years after the date the taxes were deemed paid. Okay. But a special rule for the 3 year statute says that you only get the three, if no return is filed, then only the 2 year statute applies. Okay. Well, she had no return filed. But a special rule for filing in tax court said, if the IRS issues the notice of deficiency, and this is where things get a little weird. If the IRS issues a notice of deficiency that is issued, basically, as it goes down, this is section 6512B3. The date of mailing of notice of deficiency is during the third year after the due date, then a parenthetical with extensions for filing the return of tax, and no returns were filed before such date, the applicable period becomes 3 years again. Here's the problem. We're more than 2 years after the date it was paid, right? There was no return filed because if notice of deficiency comes up first, it's deemed there's no return filed. That notice of deficiency was filed after April 15th, but before October 15th. So we're in this period where we're more than 2 years after the original due date of the return, but we're not yet more than 2 years past the extended due date. That is a problem with the way that's worded. It creates a, as was referred to by the defendant in this case, by the plaintiff in this case, a black hole into which taxes would go away. Because if the notice of deficiency would be issued from April 16th of 2013 all the way through October 15th of 2015, I should say. So from April 16th of 2016 or 2015 through October 15th of 2015, then she can't get a refund. But if the IRS didn't get the notice issued during that time frame, then, you know, that 6 month hold disappears. It's kind of interesting how that goes. So this was a problem. She actually did file a return that, as we said, properly reported the tax on August the 29th. Now, she argued there's no way, you know, Congress couldn't have meant to penalize you just for getting that extension. The tax court said, well, whether they intended to or not, the plain language creates that. The taxpayer had various very tortured ways of trying to read that sentence to say it didn't apply. Well, they, you know, the result may be strange and crazy, but it's up to Congress to fix it. So it's an interesting hole that we lost our refund. Next up, notice 2017-47. This is big. On September the 1st, 2017, this was issued. As you may remember, in the 2015 Surface Transportation Act, the due date for partnership returns moved forward 1 month this year from April 15th to March 15th for calendar year partnerships. A number of partnerships didn't get the note, so they filed their 1065, 7004s, or various other related forms after March 15th, assuming there was an April 15th due date for the partnership return. The IRS has announced that if you did that, there will now be automatic relief. Now remember, there is a catch here. You have to have filed the return by April 15th or filed a 7004 by April 15th. If you just decided there was no point filing an extension because, you know, this client come to you on April the 14th, there's no time to do it, but they're already late, you know, they're a new client, they might be out to dry. The penalty relief, though, should be automatic. That's good news. If your tax was already assessed, they should retroactively abate the penalty. And they said we should get a letter about that over the next few months. If a taxpayer does not get the letter by February the 28th of next year, then they should call the IRS with the number listed in the letter that assessed the penalty against them, and they should refer back to Notice 2017-47. Now, there are some unanswered questions about this. As I said already, if you just didn't file the extension because you thought it was too late, you know, you discovered the new due date after March 15th and before April 15th, then we don't appear to have any relief this way. We have to argue for standard relief, you know, for basically reasonable cause. Or the other issue is this doesn't really say you've given an extension. It just says no penalties. There are things that we need a valid extension for, like funding a retirement plan, you know, or making certain elections. This relief does not appear to fix that problem. So that may still be an issue for these partnerships. We'll need to wait and see if the IRS gives us any clarification on those other items. Next up, the case of Laidlaw versus Commissioner, Tax Memorandum Decision 2017-167. This is a pretty standard one. A taxpayer had their preparer file an extension of time to file a return. The preparer sent in the extension form using standard mail, did not use electronic filing, did not file it certified or registered mail. The IRS claimed they never received the extension. Now, the taxpayer had they said, look, we're in the Ninth Circuit, so there is some justification for saying the Ninth Circuit might have, because based on some old case law, they might accept the, quote, mailbox rule rather than having to have the certified mail receipt. But the court found that in this case, all we had was the preparer's statement that he'd filed the extension. They submitted this case basically without a trial, so the court never got to hear the preparer testify. So the court said, we don't know. We think his believability was crucial, and we were never allowed to hear that. The other thing they said, look, it really is still self-serving testimony for the CPA in this question to claim that, you know, he had actually filed this extension because it looks bad if he hadn't. And they said, in any event, it's going to be a real uphill fight. In the cases that they cited from the Ninth Circuit, they had produced a lot of extra testimony beyond just somebody saying, I mailed the extension. As always, make sure you use one of the protected methods for filing and for getting extensions. If you're doing extensions for a client, really got to consider if you're either electronically file them, which does serve as proof of date, or use certified or registered mail and retain the stamped white receipt that you get. Final case here is Technical Advice Memorandum 2017-34007, issued on August the 25th. This deals with common law marriages. Now, interestingly enough, common law marriages, I think, you know, many of you are probably aware of the concept. It's normally where a husband, you know, where a couple has lived together, and in most cases, it goes and has held themselves out to be married. Now, currently, Colorado, Iowa, Kansas, Montana, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Texas, and Utah recognize current common law marriages, and Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Georgia, and Florida had previously recognized them, and while they cut them off as of a certain date, they would recognize new ones, they'd still recognize old ones. So in those states, you may find somebody is common law married. In this case, the state agency had ruled that a decedent was actually in a common law marriage at the date of death. An IRS agent was asking, you know, up to national office, you know, the agent and the taxpayer in dispute, do we have to recognize that? State law generally governs what is and is not a marriage, and kind of lets me wonder why this was being submitted. Except what I suspect, there is reason to believe from the name of the agency used in this ruling that this was a Pennsylvania case. You know, Pennsylvania is one of those states that no longer recognizes common law marriage. And after Pennsylvania dropped that, but before this case became in play, we had the Supreme Court tell us that same-sex marriage works and states couldn't prohibit it. I wouldn't be surprised to see this as a same-sex situation where the couple had held themselves out as married, but the state had never officially recognized it because, you know, the state had a prohibition on recognizing marriages that were the same sex. The Supreme Court tells us retroactively that doesn't count. So we may have had a state finally have to decide this question of, well, if that's true, if somebody met the requirements to be common law married in, let's say, the state of Pennsylvania prior to, you know, when they took it away, but the only reason they weren't recognized was because the couple was same sex, is that a valid marriage? I wouldn't doubt that that may be the issue here because it involves both the state that no longer has common law marriage and it's coming out after we saw the Supreme Court's ruling that had to recognize it. But in any event, the basic rule as the IRS comes back and tells the agent is that, you know, per regulation 301-7701-18B1, if the state recognizes the marriage, then the IRS has to recognize it. It's not an option for them not to recognize the marriage. Okay. So obviously, as I said, there's some ambiguity here that was resolved. And as I said, it wouldn't surprise me to see that it was a same-sex marriage. We don't know because we don't have the details in the TAM, but it was a same-sex marriage. And that was the question being resolved because otherwise it seems like, well, yeah, they're, you know, they meet the requirements. The state says they meet the requirements. Why wouldn't it count? That might have been the reason why somebody thought it might not count. As always, please remember, check your state society CP. You know, we got a little bit of a time frame there right at the end of the month where you can probably get a little bit of CPE in between the due dates for, you know, you get your trust together because the clients still think they're due September 30th. So I'm finding we're still getting the trust information in time to do September 15th. So, you know, we have a few courses coming on that side. Also, consider the fact we all know we like to get our CP after October 15th. Well, now is the time to start paying close attention to what you might want to be signing up for in that post-August 5th, October 15th. Remember, we've got new partnership audit rules coming up that are going to start January 1st next year. And so you're probably going to be talking, and attorneys will be talking with your clients or partnerships about revising their agreements for those rules. If you haven't gotten up to speed on those, it's probably time to check your state society's offerings for the fall and early winter. Just to see if they have something, you might be able to catch up on this with one of those courses. Again, nice 8-hour course, time to talk. And the nice thing about the live courses is they can keep up with things that happen the day before the course, which is always wonderful. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 5th, 2017. You can catch our daily updates as the week goes on, as I always say, at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF that has articles for all of this week's topics. Again, go to our currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com website. That's all one word. And then go and check on the weekly updates. and go to the one for September 5th. You'll see there in the listing under it, there'll be an option to download a PDF with all these articles that has the information and links back to everything I talked about. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, Ed Zollers at CurrentFederalTaxDevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. You'll find me there at Ed Zollers. The upcoming week is a short week, so the IRS and the courts won't have as much time to release things, so I suspect we will not have nearly as many developments next week. But whatever happens next week, by the way, one big thing that may happen next week is it's reported that we might actually see a first detailed outline of what would be in the tax reform package. So we might be able to discuss that. But in any event, whatever happens next week, we'll discuss it a week from now on Current Federal Tax Developments. And I hope to see you next week, same time, same location.